This is Tommy Keene, and you're listening to 90.7 FM WGXC Accra.
Listen to music and voices. Listen to work and play. Listen to eat and drink. Listen to noise and fun. Listen to pink and blue. Listen to a heart rainbow. Listen to wizards and witches. Listen to jazz play. Listen to dogs and mice. Listen to Rome and Italy. Listen to Mars and Venus. Listen to the planet. Listen to teeth and trunks. Listen to Kaizen and Violet. Listen to stars and stripes. Listen to Texas. Listen to bells and waterfalls. Listen to churches and steeples. Dance and sing and listen and bells. Listen to making things, stripes and zigzags. Bike riding and zigzagging. No, listen to bike riding and curving. Listen to the radio going on and on. Listen to the radio WGXC.
WGXC underwriting support is provided in part by Art Omai in Ghent, New York. Open daily from dawn until dusk. Art Omai Sculpture and Architecture Park presents the work of contemporary artists and architects across 120 acres of field and forest. Now accepting advance registrations for visits on weekends and select holidays. Information at artomai.org.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Elizabeth Powell Leather Items of Craryville, New York. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. Become a WGXC sustaining supporter today. Go to wgxc.org and click donate. Thank you for your support.
From the WGXC newsroom, this is the WGXC Daily News. I'm Philip Grant. Acting Rensselaer Supreme Court Judge Adam Silberman, April 28th, sided with the town of Catskill and issued a temporary restraining order against the owners of the former Friar Tuck Inn and Resort. Silberman upheld a lawsuit filed by the town against the resort owners last week, alleging unapproved construction and unauthorized paramilitary activity. The town was granted a temporary restraining order until a preliminary injunction hearing could be held. The court ruled, and I quote, "Any defendant or agent, contract, vendee, assignee, tenant, lessee, or representative thereof served with this restraining order is hereby forbidden to engage in or host military simulation games or exercises or like activity as advertised to take place from April 30th through May 2nd until a hearing can be held in this matter," end quote. Silberman also gave the town permission to post notices on the gates and fences on the property about prohibited activity. Failure to obey the order could result in imprisonment of up to 6 months. The 200-acre property and vacant resort have been owned since February 2020 by NY32 Reality Group, Incorporated, with Eleanor Fu named as the primary owner. Thomas O'Rourke of Cohorts Entertainment and MSATO, or Military Simulations and Tactical Operations, of Wallingford, Connecticut, who intended to film at the property, is looking for more than $2 million in damages if the project is canceled. Defense attorney Michael Brandy of Buffalo said, and I quote, "We are reviewing the order and will be taking a look at our options," end quote. Read the full story at HudsonValley360.com. Dave McQuilling reports for News 10 in Albany that Ravenna's cement plant run by Holcomb Incorporated settled with the Environmental Protection Agency and the state of New York to pay a $850,000 civil penalty for local pollution. The Holcomb plant violated its state pollutant discharge elimination system permit 273 times between 2015 and 2021, including with fecal coliform, suspended solids, settable solids, and other issues. There was also an unreported sulfuric acid spill and discharges into Coyman's Creek and Hanacroy Creek, which run into the Hudson River. $212,000 of the settlement payment will go to a New York State Environmental Benefit Project for improving stormwater management at Coyman's Landing Park in the town of Coyman. The state attorney's office said Holcomb will, and I quote, undertake additional measures to ensure that the facility is fully compliant with the terms of its permit by October of 2022, end quote. The international company released a statement about its polluting plant in southern Albany County that said in part, and I quote, "This consent decree is a humbling reminder that we did not achieve our own expectations, for which we take full responsibility. We have worked closely with the state and federal government to take steps to ensure we are in continuous compliance today and into the future," end quote. You can read more about this story on the News 10 website. Amelia Teasdale is reporting for the Columbia Paper. At 1:46 p.m. on Monday, April 26th, the Valencia Falls Hydro began generating power for the first time since June 2018. The plant is located off Route 203 at the entrance to Main Street in the village of Valencia. The Valencia Falls Hydro Plant will be providing continuous power of approximately 160 kilowatts, eventually providing direct energy to the village, as well as charging the electric vehicles of plug-in stations online. Valencia Mayor Frank Bevin said, and I quote, "I think it's going to be great for the village," end quote. He noted that currently the village could not use the power from the plant yet, but it will be good, and I quote, "when we are able to," end quote. The plant was purchased in April 2020, and the team of VF Hydro and plug-in stations online used the past year to rebuild the plant and refurbish the offices. According to a plug-in stations online press release, and I quote, "with the help of former owners Fred and Bob Munch, as well as Jim Klevenstein from Klevenstein Engineering, this Federal Energy Regulatory Commission registered project was able to get back online," end quote. The Valencia Falls Hydro Plant housed the Valencia Falls Cotton Mill from 1845 to 1945. It first produced power in the early 1990s. The location is also famous for being the place where the final scene of the last movie Harry Houdini made, Hal Dance and the Secret Service. Plug-in Stations Online has installed electric vehicle charging stations in Hudson, Greenport, and Clabrick, as well as the village of Kinderhook and Valencia. The company headquarters are located in an office park in Valencia on Route 9. Read the full story in the Columbia paper. Coley Callahan is reporting for the Times Union. Independent movie theater Upstate Films will debut the Hudson Valley Picture Show, a combination of live entertainment and film screenings region-wide this summer and early fall. New Theater co-executive director Paul Strutz said, and I quote, "the idea is to create a narrative of hope and renewal as we come out of the pandemic," end quote. He went on to say, and I quote, "all of these events will be held under the stars and it will be a variety of show of sorts," end quote. The outdoor screening will launch under Upstate Films' new leadership, co-executive directors Strutz and Jason Silverman. For its summer series, Upstate Films will use a state-of-the-art outdoor projection system, including a 24-foot screen, an ultra-bright projector, and a powerful sound system to screen films ranging from the 1981 classic An American Werewolf in London to a soon-to-be-announced Janis Joplin special. Katzman Cultural Park, Opus 40, and Beerville Center, the Omega Institute, the City of Kingston and Bard College are a few of the institutions and places that Upstate Films has partnered with to produce the series. The first event takes place at Socrates Opus 40 on July 10th. Each show will feature a movie plus live entertainment such as music, poetry, dance, and conversation, and presentations from local not-for-profit organizations. Dell's Roadside from Rhinebeck will have its food truck to each location serving burgers, hot dogs, special sandwiches, and ice cream. The series will run until October 16th at locations on both sides of the river in Dutchess, Ulster, and Columbia counties. For anyone unable to catch a film in person this summer or fall, Upstate Films is also offering virtual cinema online. The theater is also currently available for rent to small parties. Read the full story in the Times Union. And that wraps up the WGXC Daily News. For local weather reports, public meetings, community information, or COVID-19 updates, visit our website at WGXC.org. From the WGXC Newsroom, I'm Philip Grant. Have a good day and a nice weekend.
Hello and welcome to the better weather for Friday, April 30th. Early morning temperatures range from 45 in Mackey to 56 in Cheviot. Mercury isn't going to climb much higher today. A regional high of 60 is expected at 1 p.m. This afternoon, wind gusts pick up, reaching 40 miles per hour, and that equates to some difficult walking and a bunch of twigs and branches will be coming down. Some power outages are expected. After sundown, a light chance of rain occurs, ending around midnight. Temperatures fall pretty far, reaching about 36 degrees, so watch those plants, bring them in, or cover them up. Tomorrow, wind gusts come to an end shortly after dawn. It will be dry with a high of 60. Sunday, a chance of rain will be present all day with a high of 72. Monday, more serious rain returns. Pollen levels for today will be medium, and for tomorrow, high. Today's tide schedule is low tide at 12:14 a.m., high tide at 6:05 a.m., low tide at 12:59 p.m., then high again at 6:47 p.m. Today's river temperature will be 54 degrees. Sunset today will be at 7:37 p.m. Sunrise tomorrow will be at 5:49 a.m. Looking way up, we see an incoming mid-latitude sourced solar wind is due to strike on Sunday. Solar wind speed is currently 314 kilometers per second at 11 protons per milliliter. Radio propagation conditions are currently fair. The 24-hour predicted KP index is 2. Quiet. The current sunspot number is 37. And this has been the Better Weather, brought to you by the Catskill Makers Syndicate.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Heidi Nielsen of Long Island City, New York. Sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You too can become a WGXC sustaining supporter by investing in community radio every month. Go to WGXC.org and click donate. Thank you for your support.
We interrupt this broadcast to bring you a special news bulletin direct via satellite from our on-the-spot task force.
Here we go for today's number. It's April 30, 2021. 10 balls. Each ball has a number. Numbers 1 through 10. Swirl the numbers. Pick a number. Today's number is 1.
Welcome to Hudson Valley Word of Mouth. I'm your host, Julia Jorn, and I live and work in Round Top in beautiful Greene County. Come along with me as I meander through the Hudson Valley, the Northern Catskills, the Capital Region, and beyond to interview the people behind the special spots and hidden gems that make our area of New York State and our collective community both distinct and diverse. You'll likely discover that you don't have to travel too far to pay them a visit. They may already be in your own backyard or just around the corner. And I'll bet their place might turn out to be that one certain destination you keep meaning to check out. So I'm here to remind you, put it on your list. Together we'll meet shop owners and small business owners, curators, designers, and artists, chefs, farmers, and culinary experts, and other creative entrepreneurs. We'll hear their own personal stories, learn about their unique offerings, and hit them up for their own local recommendations. Thanks for listening. Today I'm visiting Olana, located right outside of the city of Hudson and created by the famous Hudson River School painter Frederick Church. Join me as I go on a walk throughout the property with Amy Hausman, the director of Olana State Historic Site, and Mark Przorski, Senior Vice President and Landscape Curator of the Olana Partnership. As I drove here today across the Rip Van Winkle Bridge, I'm consistently reminded of the fascination of this place as I see Olana peeking out above the hilltops. What's the vision and history of its founder?
Frederick Church first came to this property when he was a young man, when he was studying with Thomas Cole. And he came and he walked through this landscape. He drew this landscape. He was here for 2 years in this area of the Upper Catskills. And then he went to New York City to become a very famous artist. And years later, he returned to this land just before he got married and purchased 126 acres at the bottom of this hill. And he built a farm here for himself and for his wife, Isabel, and started a family in this place. And he had a vision to kind of add on to this landscape and to create what he considered to be his perfect dream of a place. Over time, he was able to acquire the additional land where we see the Olana Main House, and he began construction on the Olana Main House in 1870 and created really a cultivated landscape here. Everything that we see at Olana is an artist-created landscape, a living painting that you can walk through, and at every twist and turn of the road, there was this idea of revealing a view that could be a painting, but in fact is actually created with trees and grass.
At one point in the 19th century, Frederick Church was the most famous artist in the United States. And what's really great about this place is that he's a painter who goes from two dimensions into three dimensions. We see this as an earthwork. His role as a landscape architect and as an architect here is part of the story. So as Amy said, how you move through and how you experience the views are part of the landscape.
As I've been coming here over the years, I've been watching the evolution of what I see as a master plan of the property. Mm-hmm. And I know exactly what you're talking about in terms of the views. I've been walking the trails and seeing the vistas, but it was really the moment that I took a tour with one of your colleagues on the little golf cart. Mm-hmm. And she was able to bring us to all of those particular views that he had envisioned mm-hmm. and planned. I don't even know how you could imagine having that sort of vision as things grow and nature changes. Did he envision this place to go on well past his lifetime?
Oh, I would say definitely.
Yeah.
When he bought this property, it had been farmed for a long, long time. There were almost no trees here. So the very first years that he was here, he planted thousands and thousands of trees. You know, you plant trees because they're going to grow and continue on after you're there. So I think that idea of legacy was something very much in his mind.
Reforestation is part of the story. Uh-huh. In the 19th century, huge parts of this region were deforested. So Frederick Church's effort to reforest and really to sculpt the landscape and to really control the views. Mm-hmm. And from Olana, you can see four states. You can see as far as Massachusetts and Vermont into Connecticut. So the views are very distant and they're also internal. He designed views across the lake where the house is reflected in the lake or where we are right now looking up at the house. This is part of the design.
The lake itself is man-made, right? Yeah. The lake was actually dammed up, a small stream that was dammed up in a small valley. He created that lake to mimic the turn in the river, and also so that you could look down into the lake and look up across the lake to see the house. It's this amazing kind of reflective mirror. He also, I think, really was interested in studying the weather. Mm-hmm. And Alexander von Humboldt, who was an 18th century philosopher and naturalist, was a hero to Church along with many others. And we often talk about the fact that this was a place where Church could come and study the sky and the movement of the clouds and the movement of the weather through this river valley. And the house itself becomes, as Mark often says, a viewing instrument through which you can see the movement of nature through this very ancient place. Yeah.
There are so many stories we can tell here. I mean, Frederick Church was involved with Central Park before he designed a lot of this landscape. He was briefly a parks commissioner in Central Park. He was one of the founding trustees of the Metropolitan Museum in New York. He was also involved with helping to create the first state park in New York around Niagara, which he painted. So there's a real sort of civic parks idea that was part of his lifetime, and today as a public park that we all experience. This is open to everyone.
Yeah, that's what I love about it. This is our central park here in our own backyard. Exactly. It's one of the premier spots in the Hudson Valley and also here in the Catskills. I could say the East Coast, but I think it's one of the most spectacular places to visit in the country. Mm-hmm. And I'm interested to hear about some of the visitors that you have and where they come from. Mm-hmm. And I'll just tell you a little story. A couple years ago, I was here, I took a walk, and I ran into a couple who was here from Texas. And they were told me that they were on a pilgrimage to see every Frederick Church in a public institution that was available for them to visit. They had been here multiple times, and they were on their way, I think, to Chicago, and they were going further and going to any museum who had a painting that they could go see. So I loved that story, and I'm just curious what types of visitors that you have that have made their pilgrimage here.
We are definitely a place where people come to make a pilgrimage because they love Frederick Church, because they love the Hudson River School, because they're drawn to the architecture and the landscape here, because they want to see the views. But this really is, I think, as you say, this is our kind of community park. And as a New York State park and historic site, this is a place that's free and open to all. And so while we have real devotees of the idea of historic house museum, we also are seeing this extraordinary growing visitation from our local community. And over the last year, we have seen people really recognize that Olana is a place where they can come to find relief. They can come to find refuge. They can come to take a walk by themselves or with their family or with their dog. And it's really become a place that people are firmly connected to, which is wonderful.
Olana operates on several levels. It's a community resource. It's considered the crown jewel of the system in New York State, historic sites. It's the most intact historic artist home and studio in the United States. It's a national historic landmark. So nationally, there's nothing else like this in the entire country. The fact that this something is so intact in artist vision is accessible. We get people from all over the country and the world. This is where you go if you want to understand that period of art or history or environmentalism. Mm-hmm. It all comes together here in a way it doesn't come together anywhere else. It's like Monticello, but tied to art and design.
Which is what I love in seeing its evolution over the years in terms of its tie to contemporary artists. Mm-hmm. And as we sit here today, I'm looking at an incredible piece here in front of the home. It looks like a tree that's been wrapped in maybe leather. Can you tell me about the artist and about the vision of the contemporary art integrated into Olana?
The Olana Partnership has commissioned Jun Shin to create a new work, a site-specific work here at Olana for the 2021 season. It's called Fallen. And it was inspired by a historic and very majestic hemlock tree that stood on the east lawn adjacent to the main house for 140 years. We know because we have dated by counting all the rings to see that it was planted somewhere between 1871 and 1886. So it was planted during Frederick Church's lifetime and stood probably with other hemlocks on the lawn. The tree died of natural causes, unfortunately, despite our very best efforts to keep it alive. And for safety reasons, we knew we needed to cut it down. And so as part of that, we have invited Jean to come to create this work. She has been interested in this idea of nature and of sustainability through the practice of her work for 20 plus years. And here she's able to honor this tree by laying it horizontally like a landscape. It's lying in state on the east lawn. It's wrapped in a second skin made of off-cut leather from the fashion industry as a reference to the tanning industry that really devastated this whole entire region here on this side of the river and on the Greene County side of the river. During the course of the 19th century, hemlock trees were used for the tannins and in their bark and were used to make leather. And so she's referencing that and referencing the idea of mass consumer, mass production, what that means to us now. And what we get to do is honor this tree that's here, that's been part of the landscape, that's been witness to all of the change that's taken place here since Frederick Church lived here, and be able to go up to it and lay our hands upon it, which I think is a really beautiful opportunity for us at this time, in this moment, in the world, for each of us. In addition, there's a mapping project that's taking place around the 250 acres of Olana, where we've invited public and volunteers to mark hemlock trees with a leather tag. So as you're walking through the landscape, your eyes are opened a little bit more to understand what the hemlock is.
This installation is really helping us to see Ohana in a new way. Our visitors are going out and discovering the hemlocks. It often takes an artist to help people to see, and Jean is doing that. And we are committed to working with contemporary artists here at Ohana. In Frederick Church's day, he was a contemporary artist. This installation is part of a bigger exhibition which opens on June 12th, which is a collaboration with the Thomas Cole Site and the Crystal Bridges Museum of Art. And here at Ohana, we'll have works by Nick Cave and Vic Muniz and Jeffrey Gibson and others, as well as Frederick Church, Thomas Cole, and Martin Johnson Heed, as well as Thomas Cole and Frederick Church's daughters. So it's really this cross-generational, across-centuries dialogue about nature and art.
This exhibition, Cross Pollination, features a range of historic and contemporary work. And in addition to Jean Shin, we also have these beautiful silk banners by the artist Portia Munson, who's from Catskill, and an incredible, wonderful artist. And those will also be installed out in the landscape. So the real goal for us is to make things as accessible as possible. So everyone who comes will have the chance to be able to experience some bit of this exhibition. They will be able to expand their view if they're able to visit inside the house and see the larger exhibition and then go across the river to the Thomas Cole site. So it's really an exciting moment for us. Here in the Hudson River Valley for the contemporary art.
There's been a project that's been ongoing is to create this idea of the Hudson River Skywalk, which crosses the Hudson River, connecting the home and studio of Frederick Church to the home and studio of Thomas Cole. It's probably the only bridge in the United States that connects the homes and studios of two major landscape artists in the birthplace of this so-called movement, the Hudson River School region. The Hudson River Skywalk allows people to walk on Ohana's carriage roads through this landscape, across the Thomas Cole site. And we are understanding this area, Ohana, the Cole site, the village of Catskill, the city of Hudson, as being its own region. There are many different arts organizations in this area.
Yeah, I mean, we really see this region as an art and cultural hub. People who come here are drawn because of the natural beauty, but it's a place of artistic inspiration and has been for hundreds of years. And we see that now with so many artists coming to visit and coming to live here, which is really rewarding.
Well, as someone who's crossed the Rip Van Winkle Bridge maybe thousands of times, I loved seeing the evolution of that Skywalk project. I thought it was an ingenious idea of bringing the two sides of the river together. Mm-hmm. And now it's just a part of, I think, people's daily life and their daily routine.
That's great to hear.
I think we're so lucky, like I said, to have it here right in our own backyard. Mm-hmm. And I take advantage of it all the time, all sorts of weather, all sorts of seasons, any time of day. So on this beautiful, sunny spring day, as the gardens are popping, I just want to thank you for welcoming us here to Ohana.
Thanks for tuning in to Hudson Valley Word of Mouth. If you're interested in checking out an ongoing list of local recommendations, or if you have recommendations of your own to share, go to my Instagram at roundtoprecommends, or visit the Wave Farm website at wavefarm.org for the Hudson Valley Word of Mouth segment archives and how to reach me. Talk to you next time.
Today I'm interviewing Gretchen Maresco, Registrar of Hedrick Hudson Chapter of the DAR, the Daughters of the American Revolution, right here in Hudson. Thank you so much, Gretchen.
I'm glad for the opportunity to talk about the DAR.
Okay, I'll let you start.
Okay, I've been a member of the DAR for about 15 years. I joined the Hendrick Hudson chapter because I live in Columbia County. It's not my native county, but I actually grew up in Ulster County. My mom isn't from Ulster County, and my dad is from Mississippi. But I had no idea that I had any Revolutionary War connections until I started doing my family history, found out I had a third cousin who was in the DAR, and decided that I would join too. And I've always been happy that I joined the DAR. It made me appreciate a lot of things about my country that I hadn't been thinking about for a long time. I actually have kind of gone crazy proving some of my ancestors. Most women who joined the DAR have one ancestor, and that's it. But I didn't stop there. So far, I've proven 22 of my ancestors to be Revolutionary War patriots in one way or another. So it's been a very interesting ride. I also have helped many other women join the DAR because of my research skills. I've been called upon to help others join and clear up little problems in their history that they needed to solve in order to be able to prove that they were descended from a Revolutionary War ancestor. So it's been a very interesting study. Anything else you're interested? I'm retired from the New York State Education Department, where I worked as an editor for the Regents exams for over 30 years. That was an interesting job, too, and I suppose the attention to detail that I learned being an editor has helped me being a genealogist as well.
Once you joined, you were obviously became very interested in genealogy and also helping people trace their lineage.
Right, that's true. I would say one thing that impressed me the very first time that I went to a DAR meeting was that they recited the Pledge of Allegiance. And I can honestly say that's something I hadn't done for decades. You know, I mean, we used to do it in school, but the DAR recites it at every meeting. And when you go to their conferences, you recite it just about at every event that happens during the conference. So I was glad to be reminded of patriotism and honoring my country and its flag. And those things are also important in the DAR. But no, I had studied my family history a little bit before I came to DAR. And like I said, I learned that a cousin had joined the DAR, and I found it was a good place to research my own family history more and also help others to research theirs. I always learn something. That's what I tell people when I do any kind of research, that every person whose lineage I look into, I learn something either about the state where they lived or migration patterns or surnames that I'd never heard of and didn't know the origin of, and it's just been very interesting.
What kind of tools do you use to research?
Almost everything you need these days is on the internet. That's not always true, because sometimes you have to go to a courthouse or a library or it's genealogical society, where they have, you know, specialized records that you just don't find any other place. I always tell people that if it's on the internet, I'm going to find it. Not always true, but more and more records are there every year. In our own chapter house, we have a very useful research library for genealogy. We have all the Columbia County church records, and we have cemetery records. Two of our members years ago found every cemetery in Columbia County they could and recorded all the gravestone inscriptions and typed them up and indexed them, and that's a very useful tool. I've been to several cemeteries myself in a number of states, taking pictures of gravestones and things, but you never quite know when you're going to find the information you're looking for. You find yourself in a lot of different places looking for things. But it's really been it's a learning process. What else can I say? I belong to a lot of programs online. Ancestry.com, FamilySearch.org, something called Genealogy Bank, and several other things. The American Ancestors, which is mainly the New England Society, and the New York Genealogical and Biographical Society. Just all kinds of things, because, like I said, you need to look for information in a lot of places, and you never can be quite sure where you're going to find it. You find yourself reading a lot of wills and old unreadable handwriting and census records and vital records, etc. It's just sort of a constant search for just little pieces of information that'll lead you in the right direction. I was going to say, I like researching old newspapers, too, because there's always a lot of information in old newspapers to be gathered. I mean, you'll find so-and-so was visiting their cousin so-and-so in the old papers, you know, the social columns, like, you know, who went to visit whom and who's, and then you find out who's, you know, maiden names sometimes. Brothers were, you know, somebody was visiting her brother, and then you say, oh, wait a minute, she's part of that family. So, and maiden names are sometimes kind of hard to figure from records. So it's, you know, like I said, you're just never quite sure where you're going to pick up a bit of information.
Gretchen, there are families in Hudson that are probably go back to the Revolutionary War. I mean, even if they came here after the war, I'm sure some were in the army or in the militias?
Well, we have, the Palatines, of course, settled Columbia County in the early 1700s, so there are lots and lots of the Palatine ancestors who were active during the Revolution. And then the Dutch who were there, of course, lots of the Dutch. The Dutch were no great friends of the English because the English just sort of came and took things over. And then in 1600s, after the Dutch had, had an established colony for quite a while, but there were, you can't make assumptions about people based on, well, this person's Italian. I guess they don't have an ancestor in the Revolution. But I found that that's not true because a lot of people who you think are Italian may have, you know, one or two ancestors in their lineage that actually do go back to early New England, or, you know, you just don't know. So until you start looking for people, and we will do research. I mean, I've done research for many people who didn't have any idea at all if they had a Revolutionary War patriot, and kind of wanted to join DAR because there's some things, you know, a lot of different things you can do as a member of DAR, and I've started from their grandparents and taken them back and found who was up the family tree. So It's always interesting to me to see where the lineage goes.
Now the DAR house,
go ahead.
It's historical. The chapter house has history in itself.
DAR chapter house, the Robert Jenkins house, was given to the chapter by a woman who was born in the house. She was the granddaughter, I believe, of Robert Jenkins, and her name is Frances Chester White Hartley. She was quite a wealthy woman. She was living in New York, and when the DAR started, she actually became a charter member of the Hendrick Hudson chapter. She joined in her hometown. The DAR ladies in the early days sought to fill a need in Hudson that wasn't being filled, and they started a library. There was no library in the city of Hudson back in the early days, and the chapter was started in a little before 1900, I'm not sure the exact date, but they started a lending library for the children of Hudson. And Mrs. Hartley realized that actually they needed a permanent home for their collection of books because the members had been keeping things in their homes, and it really wasn't convenient for a lot of people. So she decided that she would take her grandfather's house and turn it into a suitable place for a library and a meeting rooms. So she presented it to the chapter, I believe, in 1900. They had a big celebration the day of it, and she was coming up from New York by train, but got waylaid by a snowstorm, and she didn't make the dedication ceremony, unfortunately. But she did donate the chapter house to us, and it is a very interesting house historically, and we do offer tours to the public. Of course, during these days of COVID, we haven't been able to have it open as much as we have been accustomed to. But it's been, you know, we do like people to come and view it and, comment on it. We do have a lot of interesting artifacts from the city of Hudson and Columbia County. And like I said, we also have a good genealogy library there for people who are trying to track down their Hudson Valley ancestors. We don't just have Columbia County records. We have Dutchess and some from Green and some from Ulster and, you know, a varied other books that are helpful to people studying their genealogy. Plus, we have members who can help them give guidelines. I usually do a lecture once a year, a little workshop for people who are interested in getting started on their family history. But I haven't offered it last year, and I don't think I will this year either, just because of the limitations on the COVID has placed on the society these days.
I asked you, is there a process for a woman to become a member? Or if, let's say, she feels there's somebody that goes back to Revolutionary War, would she call the chapter?
You would contact me or you know, any DAR chapter near where you live, and you can find usually find someone who will help you find that ancestor and see what DAR does. Is we always build on the applications of older members too. As I said, when I joined, I had a third cousin who was a member. So I just had to provide documentation that showed that my great grandfather was all great great grandfather actually was the same as her great great grandfather. You know, I had to get my parents' documents and my grandparents and my great grandparents, and at that point, you know, my lineage intersected with hers, and then they, you know, I didn't have to prove all the way back to the Revolutionary War soldier who was a Hendrick Osterhout from Ulster County. So, but it is, it's always anybody from the public can actually look at the DAR national website and look to see who the patriots are that have been accepted already. A certain amount of the information that's there is available to the public. There's a lot of information on there that's only available to members and to registrars and other researchers such as myself, but there's a lot that's also available to the public. They do keep a lot of records. The DAR has an outstanding library in Washington at their headquarters, which I believe has been closed for over a year now, the DAR is still functioning and accepting new members and, you know, reviewing application papers. So it's a matter of, like I said, filling out an application, providing documentation that proves who your ancestor was, and then filing it with a local chapter. Not everyone is a member of a local chapter, but we think that's the best way to go because you can join a chapter near where you live and participate in the activities that each chapter offers.
Is there a phone number for the people can contact? I mean, maybe somebody on the radio will listen to this and say, I'd like to contact the chapter.
Well, there is a phone number at our chapter house, but there's not usually anyone there. there is a message there. But generally, my phone number used to be listed as the contact number for people seeking to join, and I won't mind if people call me directly and ask if they're interested and ask information about lineage research, et cetera, et cetera. I'm always willing to help people. And I'll give my phone number, which is 518-784-9221. And I'm willing to take questions about DAR and help people who might be interested in joining. I've helped many women, dozens and dozens actually, since I've been a member. And I'm always willing to take on more questions about lineage, et cetera.
You have had displays, and I've been to the DAR to see the Civil War display. Upstairs, don't you have a room where you may have artifacts? And
well, we have a lot of different things there. We have a lot of kind of antique things that directly relate to the city of Hudson. We have military uniforms. We have quite a good gun collection. The woman who gave us the house, Frances Chester White Hartley, her brother was the owner or CEO, whatever, of Remington Arms. And he amassed an interesting gun collection. Most of it is Civil War era. And we have a gun collection. We have we have things from the Civil War, from Hudson's, the Hudson unit that that participated in the Civil War. We have a lot of things from that. We have furniture, we have some pottery, we have samplers, We have a lot of different things. And I, while we're talking about the chapter house, I just want to mention that we have, it's an old building. It dates from the, I think, 1813, I think it's on the cornerstone. And it has a slate roof, which unfortunately has developed some leaks lately. And we're now going to be involved in a project in redoing that roof and fixing some other structural problems because of the leaks, which we certainly don't want to, you know, endanger our collections that we have. If there are people who are interested in being in an historic district, we have to replace the slate roof with another slate roof. You can't, you know, we can't put asphalt shingling up there. We have to put a new slate roof up there.
Are you taking... Would you be taking donations?
Definitely. I mean, that same phone number, if people are interested, I can give you, I mean, the Hendrick Hudson chapter at DAR, 113 Warren Street, Hudson, 12534. I mean, it is a significant building. Robert Jenkins was the son of one of the founders, the original proprietors of Hudson, who came... as a whaler from Nantucket or Rhode Island, I'm not sure which. I'd have to double check that. I think he was in Nantucket. and I just watched your whaling movie this morning, by the way, so just to get a little update on Hudson history. But I've given many tours of the chapter house, and in so doing, I've learned a lot about Hudson's history because I'm not a Hudson native, and I always myself wondered why Hudson would consider itself a whaling city, and I've learned a lot about DAR history and Hudson history from being a member, of course. It's been very interesting.
I was wondering if you... I thought at one time I saw a log book in a collection of a whaler's personal logbook.
Yes, we do have one log book that I'm sorry I can't tell you the name of the man who created it, but it's his logbook of, you know, one of his maybe more than one of his voyages, and it's kind of interesting because he tells, you know, what happened each day, and if it was a day that they spotted a whale or were able to catch a whale and process it, he drew a little picture of a whale in the margin on that day. So that is available. It's in our collection, and We actually had a school teacher who came and looked at it a few years ago and developed a curriculum lessons for, I'm not sure, maybe fifth graders or something like that, that were based on the book. So there is a lot of things that can be studied. We have manuscripts, and I'm not very familiar, to be honest, with the manuscript collection that we have, but we do have some old manuscripts in addition to all the books and things, but that is on display, and I mean, you would have to get special permission in order to be able to sit down and handle it and, you know, look through it, but that is in our collection. We have some things from the old General Worth Hotel, which was in Hudson. I mean, you know, things that old, that residents of Hudson who've been there for some time would remember things from the bygone era. We have city directories that go back quite a while, and histories of Columbia County, like I said, in addition to the church records and published genealogies and things like that. So it's an interesting place to browse through. We also have a rather remarkable stained glass window that was donated to the chapter by one of the husbands of one of our early members, and it's a really a beautiful, beautiful window with the DAR insignia in the middle, and it's on the landing going to the upstairs display room. We started an Instagram account too that has some information about my daughter. Actually has training in museum studies, and she's been starting to put things up on some of our accounts, but I'm just looking here for our, if you wait a minute, I'll give you our information about our website. Our website is www.hudson-dar.org. So that's our, and there are pictures of some of the interior of the house there. And our Instagram is actually www.instagram.com/Robert Jenkins House. So there are things that can be viewed, you know, either of those on the website or on the Instagram. And, you know, there are query. We also have a Facebook page. And if you send queries, you know, they'll get forwarded to the right person if you look on either of those sites.
What's the name of the Facebook page?
Oops. Let's see. The Facebook is just Hudson D.A.R. Facebook, you know, if you go on and if you put in what you're searching for, Hudson D.A.R., then you'll get the Facebook page. And I haven't been on the Facebook page for a while, but that has information about some of our activities and things like that. I mean, we've been kind of strapped for activities. We actually just had a very interesting talk the other day. We had a speaker, it was a woman who talked about the Schuyler women. She's one of the people who works at the historic site, the Schuyler Mansion historic site, and she talked to us about the Schuyler daughters, the one of whom married Alexander Hamilton.
Thank you so much, Gretchen, for today.
Thank you. I thank you for the opportunity to talk about DAR and the Hendrick Hudson chapter. I really appreciate it, and I'm happy to contribute whatever I can to people finding out their history and the history of Columbia County and Hudson and the whaling industry and whatever else. It's been very interesting.
Next, we have an interview from
WOOC.
To learn more about this program, the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org.
The repercussions from April 14th protests at South Station in Albany, as well as last Thursday's heavy-handed police dismantling of a tent encampment on Arch Street in front of the Albany Police Department's redoubt, have continued to ripple. This week, the Center for Law and Justice and NAACP joined forces for a press conference where the center's founder, Dr. Alice Green, spoke.
Violence and forced government oppression of blacks in Albany has persisted through four centuries without redress. The shooting of Eleazar Williams and the events at South Station are only two of the most recent rejections of redress. The brutal removal of the protesters was roundly criticized by many city officials and community leaders. Yet the mayor and others persist in defending the mayor's removal and her refusal to meet with demonstrators. In part, she did this by demonizing them. The mayor likened the protesters to white supremacist armed insurrectionists who tried to overthrow the United States government. Then, in sharp contrast to four centuries of unredressed black grievances, demands from white constituents this month were addressed by city officials in just 4 days, less than 4 days. A program director called for clearing the protesters' encampment from Arch Street, and the president of the police officers' union excoriated city officials for allowing the encampment to stand. Within days, the mayor ordered the forcible removal of black and brown protesters. Mayor Sheehan's continued refusal to meet with protesters mutes their voices as forcefully as Officer Anderson's attack silenced his Hickenbottom megaphone on April 14th. The mayor should have honored the protesters' request for a meeting. Hopefully, we can only hope that it's not too late. The protesters were betrayed by the city's abandonment of a liaison relationship that was designed to keep everybody safe. The Common Council should pursue the reimagined policing that was intended in the collaborative's work. As you might remember, we got nothing. So the collaborative's work needs to be done, completed, with a vision statement, goals and objectives, and a transparent timeline. We have none of that right now. The center and others stand ready to assist in designing a fair and just system of policing for all of Albany's neighborhoods and the community.
As if designed by the APD and city to counter such sentiments, police officers have been appearing at community meetings on Zoom to offer their own side, often emotional, as to recent events. Here we hear from Engagement Officer Tanya Alex Hansen speaking at this week's South End Community Collaborative meeting on Tuesday.
I will say this. Everybody keeps talking about, you know, the narrative that the city or the police department is putting out there. I can tell you the narrative, that was being put out by the protesters and you know, some of the activists in the area is not true. I work in our neighborhood engagement unit. Since last year, since George Floyd's death, since the very first protest regarding that we had in the city of Albany, me and my unit have been tasked with monitoring, supporting, escorting, numerous, countless, protests and activities in the city. But I will say this, I grew up in the city. I love the city. I grew up in South End. It's my home. I took this job because I wanted different. I wanted better. I believe in change. I support change. I don't support some of the things that have been happening. We'll go back to Wednesday. I believe it was the 14th. There was a demonstration at Townsend Park. They marched down to South Station. Again, I was tasked with assisting in the escort and traffic control, right, as they marched. The whole time, I was being called coon, house nigger, dyke. Like, what do these things have to do? Number one, these are, derogatory names that you're calling me, who, again, I support my people. I support the community. Yes, I have a job to do. And sometimes there's a gray area that people can't understand, how I'm a cop and support the community on these type of issues at the same time. But I can, and I do. But that's not helping the cause. That it takes away from the legitimacy of people protesting true issues in society, in our community. I've talked to a number of officers who are from the community and are hurting. We're all hurting. You know, this is our city too, and we love it. And our family and friends are here. We want better. But the path that we are on is not making anything better. It's not making things better. You know, we're all talking about how much you all are hurting. We're hurting too. I invite anybody, I've talked to some of the officers, and we're willing to go out and have those conversations on the ground and figure out what we can do, because it's obviously not happened. We've been doing this for a year now. And I don't think that we have really moved the needle very much in the direction we're trying to go.
Finally, we return to the recent press conference where former Albany Common Council member Barbara Smith, who premiered the city's equity agenda when she was serving on the council, spoke.
This situation has to change. Where we are now is particularly demoralizing to me, because I personally know how hard so many of us have worked to change the historically adversarial relationship between the police and residents, specifically residents in our communities of color. Countless individuals, including Dr. Green and our dear departed friend Vera Mike Michelson, advocated for community policing so that officers could get to know the people in the specific areas in which they worked and so that residents could get to know them. We demanded and got transparency from the department when